You are listening to Louisiana Considered, a new daily show about South Louisiana from WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Carl Lengel. We're covering the top stories, bringing you lively conversations with region's journalists, newsmakers, and artists. And we'll be coming to you live Monday through Friday, every day at noon. And joining me today is News Director Patrick Madden.
And on today's show, we'll hear about the growing homelessness crisis here in Louisiana. And a little later, we'll hear an interview from Tegan Wendland on a new study on cancer rates in St. John the Baptist Parish, and also about a new recycling program for festivals and parades.
And first, we're going to get an update on the weather, and the winter storm has disrupted life for so many of us in the South right now. Joining us by phone is meteorologist Dan Holliday. Well, we're having a little technical difficulty, but we are going to work it out quickly here. And here's Dan now.
It's 1925.
Dan, thanks for stopping in again. Good grief. We're spending a lot of time with you lately. What's going on today?
Well, there is a cold front that has making its exit on off to the east of us. And behind that, it's left behind some cooler air today. And what we're concerned about is the colder air mass in place tonight has prompted the National Weather Service to issue a freeze warning. So temperatures are going to get into the upper 20s and low 30s across our area. All of the river parishes west of New Orleans, south of Lake Pontchartrain, and, of course, the Bayou region parishes all around there going to be probably at the freezing mark or slightly below overnight.
And this weekend, am I going to get my park walk in or not?
You are going to be able to get it in. The good news is you might need a jacket on Saturday, but conditions do improve on Sunday. It does look, however, though, we will have another cold night, Friday night, with temperatures dipping down to around the freezing mark, around 32. But the good news is by the end of the weekend, we are in the mid-60s for the high, and that's normal for us for this time of year.
So wrapping up February, any surprises early next week? Another vortex dropping down to visit us?
No. The good news is with that is it looks like the western part of the country is now going to be, I would say, from next week all the way through early March, looks like they're going to be in the cold sort of zone. And the central and eastern part of the U.S. are going to be normal or at least average temperatures and above average. So looking into early next week, Monday's high temperature will be in the low 60s, and we may approach 70 degrees by Wednesday.
Nice. I'll qualify this with, it's always good to hear from you, I think. But we'll be talking to you again soon, I'm sure, Dan.
Absolutely. Thank you, Carl.
I'm Patrick Madden, and you're listening to Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. The homelessness crisis in America has only been worsened by the pandemic. From a fraying social safety net to rising housing costs, nearly 1 in 500 Americans is homeless, according to estimates. Here in Louisiana, two news organizations this week published big features on the homelessness crisis: Gambit Weekly and the online outlet Southerly Magazine. Gambit reporter Sarah Ravitz in this week's cover story goes in depth on how New Orleans' cash-strapped agencies are struggling to help the city's homeless population. And Katie Berlin is the Southerly's Gulf Coast correspondent based here in New Orleans. Her latest feature focuses on Southwest Louisiana and in particular Lake Charles, which was ravaged by hurricanes Laura and Delta, and that's exacerbated a pre-existing housing crisis there. That story was supported by the Pulitzer Center. Sarah and Carly, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Carly, let's start with you. Your article in Southerly follows a woman named Sasha Miller in Lake Charles. She has a job, she's a single mom, and she's renting a place before the hurricanes hit and appears to have stable housing, but it all falls apart after the storms devastate the city and she ends up unhoused. Can you tell us about Sasha, her story, and what it illustrates about the larger problem in Lake Charles right now?
I think Sasha's story really illustrates all of these different challenges that renters in Lake Charles are facing after the hurricane. So, you know, she got evicted. A lot of evictions were happening in the weeks after the storms. She got a first round of assistance from FEMA, which through the interviews I've done, I've heard of a lot of folks getting, you know, they got enough money directly after that first storm to kind of tide themselves over for 2 months. And then they applied for more assistance and there were huge delays. You know, part of that is likely due to a second storm hitting and complicating that reapplication process. And so she, you know, ends up unhoused. And I think a lot of people who were safely housed before the hurricanes, you know, were then pushed into homelessness for the first time after these storms. And, you know, everyone is dealing with the pandemic also under all of this. And so, you know, this wasn't necessarily the case for Sasha, but I know for a lot of people, people had lost jobs or, you know, didn't have the kind of safety net prior to this other disaster. And then, you know, second hurricane also hitting on top of all of this.
Sarah, let's turn to your story in this week's Gambit. You point out that the agencies and nonprofits that serve the city's homeless population are hurting financially, but they're also facing increasing demand. How would you describe the homelessness situation right now in New Orleans?
Sure. So right now, one of the biggest concerns is that when the federal eviction moratorium ends at the end of March, there's going to be a wave of homelessness. People are kind of bracing themselves for that and really hoping that it will continue to be extended as it has been a couple times over the past year. But yeah, you know, the shelters are pretty full. They've also, you know, they had to reduce capacity to accommodate the COVID guidelines and keep people, you know, 6 feet apart as, you know, as much as possible and increase sanitary measures. But there's also, you know, increased demand because, you know, like Carly said, there's a lot of people over the past year who are experiencing homelessness for the first time because of COVID, because of, you know, being out of work, and also because of hurricanes. There were a lot of evacuees who came to New Orleans and have still not been able to return to Lake Charles.
Sarah and Carly, in both of your stories, one of the through lines is that there is an affordable housing crisis, that rental costs are extremely high in both Lake Charles and New Orleans. Did any experts or anyone else you spoke with talk about any solutions to this part of the puzzle? Sarah, why don't you go first?
Permanent supportive housing is a pretty viable solution and has been pretty successful. That's when people who are experiencing homelessness get matched with a caseworker who can help them, you know, manage disabilities and if they need medication and, you know, doctor's appointments and, you know, help finding employment. That's been really helpful. That's sort of the goal of the city's health department is to get as many people into that as possible. But it does take a lot of effort. It also involves, you know, different agencies, including Unity of Greater New Orleans, which is sort of this, Unity of Greater New Orleans is an umbrella organization that oversees different advocacy groups and feeding sites and puts people in shelters that can suit their needs. Like, you know, women escaping domestic violence will go to one place, someone facing addiction might go to another place. So they've been really helpful and supportive, but, you know, there is an increased demand, and they are certainly bracing themselves for more.
Carly, in Lake Charles, you point out how the affordable housing crisis was a problem even before the hurricanes and the pandemic, right?
It's many years in the making, you know, with the natural gas boom in that part of the state. Lake Charles saw an influx of workers who preferred to rent and really kind of squeeze the market. And so Rental prices have been on the rise for quite some time, and with so much of the housing stock destroyed or really badly damaged, that only kind of further exacerbates that problem. And so I think what I would say, though, is that this just needs to be a priority in the rebuilding process, you know, whether that's providing incentives for landlords or developers to, you know, be building back housing at an affordable price point. I think that's really crucial to get folks who have been displaced from the area or who are there but not safely housed at this time back into, you know, viable living situations in the area.
And finally, I want to ask you both the same question. Sarah, I'll start with you first, but what are the big takeaways from your reporting on this issue?
One of the big takeaways that I found, and this sort of applies to a lot of different crises that New Orleans and South Louisiana have faced over the past several years, is that it's really sort of on people that have stepped in to, you know, run these mutual aid organizations and charitable aspects of going out there when the government cannot step in. And the, you know, the city's health department is pretty strained right now with COVID response. So, you know, it's kind of in a triage situation. So it's, you know, really been because of the generosity of certain people who have been helping.
You know, I want to echo Sarah too and just say that I've heard so many stories just about the incredible generosity of people in Southwest Louisiana and outside providing aid and donations. But I think my biggest takeaway is something that one of my sources in the piece, Bill Quigley, who's a civil rights lawyer and teaches at Loyola Law School, said, which is just that this warrants a response from all levels of government and it hasn't received it. I think, you know, a lot of folks in this part of the state feel forgotten after these storms. There's, you know, hasn't been a whole lot of coverage of the area. And I think just a sense of urgency, frankly, is needed in order to address all of these kind of cascading crises that are facing folks there.
That's Sarah Ravitz of The Gambit and Southerly Magazine's Carly Berlin. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So if you're walking down the street sometime.
You're listening to Louisiana Considered here on WWNO and WRKF. I'm Carl Lengel. A new study finds extremely high levels of cancer and other illnesses in a predominantly black area of St. John the Baptist Parish. Residents have long complained of industrial pollution from chemical plants and refineries, saying the pollution is making them sick, but there's been a dearth of public health data to prove these claims. Now, the advocacy group, the University Network for Human Rights, is trying to prove that with this study. Coastal Desk reporter Tegan Wendland talked with researcher Ruhan Nagra about their findings.
So your study really focused in on people who live near the Denka manufacturing plant, which makes chloroprene, a synthetic rubber that's used to make hoses and insulation and stuff like that. What do we know about the health effects of breathing it?
Right. So chloroprene exposure is linked to a number of different health impacts, most notably cancer. Chloroprene is considered a likely human carcinogen by the EPA. Chloroprene is also linked to non-cancer health outcomes, cardiac symptoms like chest pain and heart palpitations, difficulty breathing, skin irritation, eye irritation, headaches, respiratory symptoms. Our survey attempted to gather data on that range of chloroprene-linked health outcomes.
So a few years ago, state officials said they'd do their own study in the same area that you focused in on. That was after years of advocates and neighbors pushing for some kind of action in this area, saying that people were getting sick and dying. So why did you zoom into this particular region?
We had like several brainstorming sessions with community members to kind of talk about, you know, what are the community's objectives? What are the community's priorities? And what people told us was, we know anecdotally that there are abnormally high levels of cancer in our community. It seems like everyone's dying from cancer. And we know from the EPA that we have the highest risk in the country of getting cancer from air pollution. But what would be helpful is to actually have a health survey that actually documents instances of cancer and other chloroprene linked health outcomes. So that was how this all started.
So you've been studying this region for several years, and you initially put out this study a couple years ago, but now it's been peer-reviewed and it's being published in a well-known journal. So tell me a little bit more about the process.
So initially, when we put out this study, first of all, we did not initially seek peer review of the study because we were on a very tight time frame. It's an urgent public health crisis as far as we're concerned, and we felt ethically obliged to get this information out to community members as quickly as possible. Once the study was released, the major, I think, criticism of it was that it relies on self-reported health information that's not verified by medical records. The other sort of related piece was this critique that our study is not peer reviewed. So we went ahead and went through that process, which we had planned on doing, but, you know, on a slower time frame.
In the course of working on this project and going over the data after interviewing all of these folks in the field and getting some sense of, you know, what the health impacts are, what did you find most striking or surprising about your findings?
What we found most shocking about our findings was the association between adverse health outcomes in the survey sample and household proximity to the Denka facility. For cancer prevalence and for almost every chloroprene-linked adverse health outcome that we studied, there was a correlation between proximity to the Denka facility and the prevalence of that outcome. In the zone closest to the Denka facility, that's zone one, the area within a kilometer and a half of the Denka facility, there was much higher cancer prevalence and much higher prevalence of other chloroprene-associated health outcomes than in zone two, which was further from the facility.
Are you hopeful that the Biden administration's commitment to stricter regulation of pollution is going to address some of these issues?
Yes and no. I would say yes, because obviously the change in administration is welcome, and there's currently a peer review process underway within the EPA. The EPA is reviewing, at Denka's request, its IRIS assessment for chloroprene toxicity. Denka is currently challenging EPA's assessment of chloroprene as a likely human carcinogen. And that process is currently underway. And so, yes, I'm hopeful that the Biden administration will ensure that the assessment of chloroprene toxicity remains exactly as it is, which is that it is a likely human carcinogen. So yes, it's helpful. That said, you know, these problems have been around since before the Trump administration. These are long-standing, deep-seated issues. And so, yes, hopefully it's a new day and they'll finally be addressed, but they haven't been addressed for many, many years.
Now, of course, advocates have been fighting for a long time in this region to have some of these health issues addressed. And in response, a couple of years ago, the state had committed to doing its own study, looking specifically at the area that you've done around the Denka plant. Do you think the state's doing enough to address these concerns?
Not at all. And so the state undertook its initiative to do this. I actually would not call it a study. It's more of an audit of the Louisiana Tumor Registry. It began as a response to the release of our study. So our study understandably created a lot of concern among residents as well as government officials about the health situation of the area around the Denka facility. In the Louisiana Tumor Registry audit, there's no measure of exposure. If you don't measure exposure, it's not a study. You're not actually answering any questions about potential links between emissions and health outcomes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ruhan Nagra with the University Network for Human Rights.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Louisiana Considered on WWNO and WRKF. I'm Carl Engel. That was Coastal reporter Tegan Wendland speaking with researcher Ruhan Nagran. Now, Alma Robichaud of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, a Louisiana nonprofit which has been awarded a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency, is here to talk about festivals going a little greener. BitNep got a $500,000 grant. That's a lot of money from the EPA to help clean up a few Louisiana festivals. Most of it's going toward the French Quarter Fest, from what I understand, in New Orleans. What's the vision for that program?
That is true, and we're hoping that it's not only going to clean up a few festivals, but all the festivals, because what the deliverable is going to be out of this is going to be a sustainable festival planning guide. And so we're going to create something for the Gulf of Mexico program, so for the five states of the Gulf of Mexico, to where someone who's planning a festival can pick it up and follow the directions to make sure that their festival is more sustainable, that they produce less waste, more things are recycled or composted, and that we keep as part of a trash-free waters effort to make sure that we keep all of our trash out of the water.
So the French Quarter Fest just kind of serves as an exemplary model that will procreate to the other programs and build on that.
Correct. I was looking for the right festival, and of course with 400 different festivals each year in Louisiana, we are like the festival capital of the world.
We are.
Celebrate everything. And the French Quarter Festival, because my kids and I used to do the Satchmo Festival, the Louis Armstrong Festival, so we began there, and I called and talked to the director there, and they were very interested. In fact, last year, I guess 2019, they had started an effort to become more sustainable and to increase recycling and not have so much waste. So they were a perfect match, and they have a great fellow working over there, Andrew Woodruff, who has sketched it all out, and I think it's going to be wonderful.
Now, what kinds of items are we talking about replacing here?
Well, what we're talking about is putting up different trash stations. And so we're going to have them around there. They're going to be staffed with paid staff just to make sure things go into the right bucket for this first year and probably the second year. So when somebody wants to go throw away their Coke bottle or throw away their paper bowl that they just ate jambalaya out of, they'll go to the trash station and they will be directed where to put it, whether to put it in recyclable, whether to put it in composting, or if it is truly going to go to the landfill, to the trash, they'll have a trash place as well. So that's one thing that we're going to be doing, and that I think will be a big part of the education of this grant. Then we're also going to have an incentive for the vendors that are coming in. Of course, the festival is known for its food and its wonderful drinks and festivities. So the vendors that are going to be coming in, they will have a reduced vendor price if they use compostable and recyclable material to serve their food items, say their plant-based forks, their bowls that are paper instead of plastic, no styrofoam. Styrofoam is not recyclable, nor is it compostable. So we're hoping to make these little changes, and in exchange for the vendors spending that little extra money the first year or two to get these products, they will be compensated by having lower vendor fee.
How did this program come about? You saw piles of trash and went, this has got to stop?
Well, yeah. I've been working with Trash-Free Waters at EPA, and of course our goal is 50 years to have trash-free waters, no trash in the waters at all. As the education outreach coordinator for the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, BitNEP, I take students out to the beach all the time on Elmore's Island, and we pick up a lot of trash. So trash-free waters has been a big deal. And when I saw this grant came out, I thought, what an excellent idea. You know, let's stop throwing things on the ground. Let's make sure they get to the right place. And let's stop filling up our landfill with stuff that could be recycled or composted and maybe turned into something else.
Well, Alma, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for what you're doing. We got to make the world a better place, you know?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Louisiana Considered on WWNO and WRKF. I'm Carl Lengel. That wraps up Thursday's show of Louisiana Considered. We want to thank all of our guests, Sarah Ravitz of The Gambit, Carl. Carly Berlin of Southerly Magazine, researcher Ruhan Nagra, and meteorologist Dan Holliday. Tomorrow's program, the Politics Roundtable, features New Orleans Council member Helen Moreno. Thanks to engineers Garrett Pittman, and Adam Voss. This is Louisiana Considered.